Mr. Bromley, how you doing today, sir?
Hey, Chris. Happy July. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing very good. Kind of amazed. We were on a call today and somebody said, yeah, let's check back in a month in August. And I went, wait, what? August?
It's up on you.
Yeah, it's coming. So going to Black Hat this year. I'm excited about that. I think we've talked about that on the show before. We'll record an episode down there. And yeah, it should be some fun.
That'll be fun. I'm looking forward to it. I'll be there with you. I mean, I'll be there as well, I should say. I don't think we're going to be spending the entire time together, but we'll both be there.
Oh, that reminds me. I'm going to check with Charlton and make sure we got a seat for you at dinner.
Ooh, excited. Just in case anyone's curious, Charlton on the Lima Charlie team is fantastic at choosing dinner locations. Just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, he's great. He makes sure the team goes out for dinner whenever we all travel for a conference or something like that. So, and he's, you know, finds the weird, highly sought after spot to eat. Usually you all have to show up before they'll seat you. Like, that's how busy these places are. So they won't give you the reservation unless everybody's there on time.
That's a good sign, I think.
Yeah, and what a great way to, like, you know, build the team and have a good experience when you're traveling. Because often, like, people think it's awesome traveling for conferences. Oh, you get to go all these places. And it's like, you see the airport, you see the hotel, you see the conference floor. And if you're lucky, you can get, like, an hour for dinner or maybe run into a museum for 20 minutes or something like that. It's
Chris, I remember, I think you and I, won Black Hat, maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, had, I think we ate dinner at the side table just because we were so busy. It's just, we just grabbed something quick from the cafeteria. Maybe it was lunch, I can't remember, but it was not glamorous at all. Like, for people who are like, oh, you go to Vegas for a few days? I'm like, yeah, but I eat like I'm in a barracks, just so you know. Yeah. It's not as illustrious as everyone thinks it is.
And paying $20 a coffee and stuff. Oh, my
God.
Yeah,
no, that's just too much. Although, like, I feel like globally we're getting there, but that's another discussion for another time.
Sure. The other thing I wanted to cover at the beginning here was I ended up buying The Scaling Curve. I ordered that book after you mentioned it last week on the podcast. And reading it so far, I'm probably, like, I don't know, a third of the way through.
Okay.
You know, really kind of falling in love with Dario Amati and, like, what a great bunch of folks at Anthropic. And then today I saw the post from Abnormal Security. I'm not sure if you've seen it.
I haven't. No.
But they're getting sued for trademark infringement by Anthropic, despite the fact they started their company 3 years before Anthropic and have had the same logo since 2021, which was like months after Anthropic launch. So a little bit disappointed in them for taking such an aggressive action against those guys instead of, you know, having a conversation or something. But I'm gonna keep telling myself this high-minded AI genius who's gonna shepherd in the super intelligence era had nothing to do with the trademark dispute.
Nothing to do with it, I'm sure. I mean, honestly, like, if you read it, and again, not trying to exude fanboy vibes here or anything like that. I don't think he would have had time to even think about this.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just this is one thing. It's really easy. This actually comes up in a lot of the articles that we talk about too, especially as we report on some of these events that come up. It's really easy on the outside to be like, oh, well, of course they knew, you know, of course this was happening. And it's like, folks, I'll be honest with you. I've given presentations before where I needed to create a logo for a thing as a joke, as part of the presentation. And I literally go to an AI logo creator. Hey, do this, blah, blah, blah. I'm given the presentation. It's to a closed room. Someone comes up and is like, hey, that logo looks a lot like such and such. And I was like, I wish I could show you the recording of me bringing this thing to life. I didn't even know that was real. And Chris, what I've arrived at is ultimately, there's probably a finite number of ways you can combine geometric shapes together. And eventually every logo will get exhausted. So,
yeah, there's no new ideas. Isn't that a thing?
Yeah, it's It's always been thought of before.
That's right. All right. Got some interesting AI stuff today, so let's jump in. Google has fixed a vulnerability in its Dialogflow CX platform that could have allowed attackers to steal data from AI agents and chatbots built with the service. The flaw is dubbed Rogue Agent by Varonis Threat Labs and was described as a permission boundary issue that affected Dialogflow CX's code block feature. According to Varonis, an attacker could have injected persistent malicious code into a chatbot's execution pipeline, enabling silent exfiltration of conversations and even large-scale phishing campaigns. Exploitation required only the ability to update a single permission. And on the Dialogflow agent, Varonis reported the issue to Google in November 2025. Google released an initial patch in April of 2026 and fully resolved the vulnerability the following month. Google stated that all affected components have been fixed. No customer action is required, and there is no known evidence of customer compromise. Dialogflow CX is used to build enterprise AI agents for applications such as customer support, financial services, and healthcare, where conversations frequently contain sensitive information. Developers can extend these agents using code blocks, which are custom Python code snippets capable of processing user input, manipulating data, and calling external APIs. These code blocks execute inside Google's managed Cloud Run environment. According to Google, Cloud Run instances have public network egress by default, allowing outbound internet connections. Because all Dialogflow agents using code blocks within the same Google Cloud project share the same Cloud Run execution environment, and because that environment is fully managed by Google, customers have limited visibility into what is happening during execution. Varonis noted that this architecture could make malicious modifications difficult to detect because key portions of the attack would occur outside the customer's direct visibility. The attack centered on Dialogflow CX playbooks, which help customers build AI agents using natural language and generative AI capabilities. If an attacker obtained permission to modify a playbook's code block, for example, by compromising a privileged employee account, they could replace an internal execution file with a malicious version that would persist across future chatbot conversations. This could allow access to conversation history and session data, while also enabling phishing attacks embedded naturally into chatbot interactions. One example described in the article is inserting fraudulent reauthentication prompts designed to convince users to reveal valid credentials. Although attackers would still need to initial access to an account and required the playbook's update permission, which could be assigned at the project level, meaning exploitation was not limited to the highest level administrators. Even though the vulnerability has been mitigated, Varonis recommends that organizations review playbook update logs, investigate failed user requests that could indicate malicious logic, and manually inspect code blocks for unauthorized changes. Tamir Yehuda, cloud security research team leader at Varonis, emphasized that organizations should not only focus on AI models while overlooking the cloud infrastructure supporting them. He said AI services are tightly integrated with cloud services, creating risks that may not be immediately obvious. He also warned that cloud misconfigurations can expose alternative paths to AI chatbots or their data through other cloud services. He compared cloud infrastructure to a game of Jenga, arguing that because every component is interconnected, compromising a single element can have a much broader security consequence. So really cool to see responsible disclosure, patching, and then publication. So that seems to be a trend lately, which is great to see. And, you know, they call out that users don't have visibility because it's in Google's cloud. I would much rather have Google watching my cloud than my small team of folks. It's just to put that out there.
I think you do, actually, Chris, if I'm not mistaken. But that said, I view this as kind of just a shelf it as a cloud infrastructure protection. You need to know how this thing operates kind of a thing and whatnot. Maybe cloud security posture management is the correct terminology there. Google found a vulnerability, right? They went through and they patched it up, which is great. And it just happens to be associated with a lot of chatbots and agents and things like that. I think it's a really, really interesting article in understanding the workflow of how these things come together. Varonis, however you pronounce this, really, really awesome blog post. I do like the fact that they pulled a lot of diagrams together, Chris, to help kind of illustrate exactly what's happening and what's going on here. Where I think this gets a little bit tricky for some organizations is they might not understand the permissions that are associated with this. They might not understand the potential impact. They might not understand how the adversary might do what they do. A lot of times when we see cloud management infrastructure compromises, a lot of times it's to like spin up VMs and launch coin miners or do something like that. This is one that would be a little bit more malicious for sure, a little bit more nefarious, if you will, because it does, you know, have an adversary kind of jump into the chatbot execution process or run book, for lack of a better term, get in there and you know, drop some code blocks in. That could end up stealing data or routing people to the wrong place and whatnot. They claim that they haven't seen any of this done in the wild. So hat tip Varonis for like really, really investigating and digging into this one. I just think this is going to be a continued like, hey, if you're going to deploy cloud hosted infrastructure, platform as a service, software as a service, infrastructure as a service, whatever it functions as a service, whatever it is, Chris, you've got to have the right types of controls and the visibility into what you are deploying and just understand the security risks there. Again, this type of thing does require the right account and the right permissions in order to be successful. It doesn't mean it those things don't ever come together. So the other takeaway here is don't be doing this stuff with a root account. Don't be doing this stuff with high privileges, you know, escalate when needed, be least privileges possible, zero trust, so on and so forth. Do all those things that help protect credentials and help protect your environment. So that way, this type of, you know, vulnerability or this type of exposure isn't really a thing for you to worry about. But again, hat tip to the team over at Varonis for finding this and documenting it for us.
Yeah. And another gentle reminder that, you know, all this AI stuff is getting rolled out real fast. And if an organization like Google can miss something like this, I promise you all the other ones can too. So
absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it definitely can.
All right. Next up, a new phishing campaign known as Evil Tokens is demonstrating a technique referred to as ghost phishing, where the malicious content remains hidden until it is decrypted and rendered inside the victim's web browser. According to the article, this creates a blind spot for traditional email security controls because the phishing page appears harmless during initial URL inspection. The campaign uses Microsoft device code phishing, persuading victims to complete a legitimate Microsoft authentication flow that unknowingly authorizes attackers to access Microsoft 365 accounts without directly stealing passwords. The phishing page itself is encrypted using AES-GCM, preventing static URL scanners and many network-level security tools from seeing the content that is ultimately displayed to the user. The article explains that because the phishing content is only revealed after browser-side decryption, security teams may experience delayed detection and response. Potential consequences include longer exposure to compromised Microsoft 365 accounts, unauthorized access to emails, files, and cloud services, increased investigation workloads, and incomplete evidence for identifying and blocking related attacker infrastructure. Any.run reports that its interactive sandbox was able to reveal the full attack flow by observing what happened inside the browser after the encrypted content was decrypted and displayed. The analysis also exposed the Microsoft device code workflow used by the attackers, allowing investigators to better understand the campaign's behavior and collect relevant indicators of compromise. Threat intelligence data presented in the article shows Evil Tokens activity concentrated across the United States and Europe, with organizations in technology, manufacturing, education, banking, consulting, financial services, and managed security service providers identified as primary targets. The article also cites phishing exposure statistics gathered from sandbox submissions across 15,000 organizations during 2026. Consulting organizations experienced phishing exposure of 75.6%, followed by financial services at 72.8%, manufacturing at 71.9%, and it just keeps going down. I'll stop reading numbers. The article notes that a single compromised Microsoft 365 account can expose sensitive information, enable business email compromise and fraud, and significantly increase incident response costs. The article recommends browser-level analysis as an effective way to detect this type of phishing attack. With Any.run's interactive sandbox, analysts can observe DOM snapshots showing when the hidden page changes, inspect HTTP requests supporting the device code authentication flow, review URL details, and collect indicators such as domains, endpoints, hashes, and other infrastructure used by the attackers. There's the marketing pitch. The platform also generates AI-assisted investigation reports that summarize observed behavior, indicators, and recommended response actions, helping analysts transfer investigations more efficiently between security operations team. The article concludes that modern phishing attacks increasingly evade detection during email and URL inspection alone, making browser-level visibility an important component for detecting hidden phishing activity before compromised accounts develop into larger security incidents. Yeah, outside of the, like, hey, we do all this stuff really well, you should buy our product, which I think that's what that was. This is super interesting, right? New technique for getting past that first layer of defense that a lot of teams rely on, and using, you know, valid authentication workflows. Like, that's hard stuff to not get caught up in.
Yeah, really liking the graphic that was delivered with this, by the way. I mean, that's actually pretty awesome. Kind of a digitally generated ghostwriter, if you will. I thought that was pretty
Grim
sweet.
Reaper,
Yeah,
perhaps?
right. Yeah, maybe Grim Reaper is the better way to frame it. Who knows? I don't know. I see like flames coming off, so who knows? Hey, hat tip to the adversaries. Jokes
Hockey's
aside.
over, Matt.
Yeah, oh my God, hockey is over, and I'm missing it already because now we have to. No, never mind. We'll leave World Cup scores out of this conversation. We
I got
won't
a
go with
couple of those on my team too.
that. Yeah. But no, with that said, the adversary's figuring out really something pretty novel here from a defense evasion perspective, right? Figuring out how to basically encrypt this page until it gets opened up and gets rendered actually in the DOM itself. I know a lot of security analysis tools and probably phishing automation tools and things that are doing like landing page analysis and whatnot likely depend on that. And if they can't read it, unfortunately, Chris, a lot of times security vendors are like, oh, I can't read it, so we just kind of let it go. They don't necessarily treat that behavior as malicious unto itself because it's not uncommon. You being, or not you, but a tool being unable to read a web page does not mean the web page is bad. It could be programmatic, it could be AI generated, it could be an API or something like that. So this idea of, oh, we can't read it, therefore it's bad, gets around sandboxing. It can get around some initial page scraping tools and stuff like that. And I think the adversaries just found a really unique way around it. Back then, not back then, but after that, once it's done, we then get into kind of the typical run-of-the-mill stuff, right? Device code phishing, looking to steal attack tokens and attack tokens, but user tokens and whatnot. And then, going after kind of O365 accounts that are, given access post 365 and whatnot and post MFA. And really, where I'm kind of going with this is it's just another, tools attackers, tools attackers, tools attackers. We're just continuing to play whack-a-mole a little bit. They found a new technique. They found a new thing that allows them to hide some pages or whatnot. I wouldn't be surprised if we see some new security measures or some new detections or perhaps even new browser detection capabilities where you can kind of sandbox the results before you show them to the user and stuff like that. So I think this is just one of those up and down games. And we'll see what comes of it, but I would expect to see some security improvements in the future.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I was actually thinking while I was reading this that I should bring this over to the engineering team and see what our Chrome EDR sensor can do with
That would be
this.
cool to see. I would be, yeah, I wonder.
I
And
know
for
it's pretty limited visibility, but I think we get URLs and probably get the DOM and stuff like that, so I'm sure we could do something.
yeah, I'm thinking browser extension monitoring, not monitoring browser extensions, but a browser extension that monitors would probably be a better solution here because it's going to be able to see that content rendered live.
Yeah. All
Now,
right, this one's for you, Matt. The US
neither of us,
cybersecurity.
are going to advertise any products, Chris, unlike that article did, but we're just going to throw the idea out there of extension-based monitoring might be the way to go. Hint, hint.
All right. As I was saying, this one's for you, Matt. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, aka CISA, has added four newly exploited vulnerabilities to its known exploited vulnerabilities or KEV catalog and is requiring federal agencies to patch them by July 10th under Binding Operational Directive 26-04. The vulnerabilities affect Adobe, ColdFusion, LangFlow, and two Joomla extensions. CISA warns that all four are flaws that are being actively exploited in the wild and advises all organizations, not just federal agencies, to review the KEV catalog and remediate these vulnerabilities as quickly as possible. The Adobe ColdFusion vulnerability tracked is, I'm not going to read all the CVEs, but it has a CVSS score of 10. It's a path traversal flaw that allows arbitrary code execution. Adobe released patches for the issue on June 30th, and CISA added it to the KEV catalog only days later after evidence of active exploitation emerged. The second vulnerability affects LangFlow with a CVSS score of 9.9. It's a cross-tenant insecure direct object reference or IDOR vulnerability that allows attackers to execute flows belonging to other users by supplying a flow UUID. The issue was fixed in LangFlow version 1.9.1, according to the article. Sysdig observed attackers exploiting the vulnerability beginning on June 26, despite there being no public proof of concept exploit available at the time. The observed LangFlow attacks involve multiple stages. Attackers first performed reconnaissance on the host, harvested flow identifiers, replayed those identifiers to trigger the IDOR vulnerability, and then chained the attack with another CVE, a remote code execution vulnerability in LangFlow that had been patched in March. This combination allowed attackers to progress from unauthorized access to code execution. Following confirmation of active exploitation, CISA instructed federal agencies to apply patches for both the ColdFusion and LangFlow vulnerabilities within 3 days. The remaining two vulnerabilities affect Joomla extensions and are assigned a CVSS score of 10, impacts the SP Page Builder extension from JoomShaper, and is an improper access control vulnerability that enables unauthenticated remote code execution. The flaw exists in the extension's custom icon upload feature, which is accessible without authentication and writes files directly to the web root, allowing attackers to execute PHP code on vulnerable servers. The issue was fixed in SP Page Builder version 6.6.2. According to the article, attackers have already exploited the vulnerability to create hidden administrator accounts on Joomla websites and deploy PHP file manager backdoors. The fourth vulnerability also carries a CVSS score of 10 and affects the Page Builder CK extension from Joomlack. It's an unauthenticated arbitrary file upload vulnerability that can lead to remote code execution on the underlying web server. The flaw was resolved in Page Builder CK version 3.6.0, released on June 27th. The article states that threat actors began targeting the vulnerability within hours of the patch release to deploy web shells. CISA's guidance is that federal agencies patch all four vulnerabilities by July 10th, while recommending that all organizations promptly review and remediate any vulnerabilities listed in the KEV catalog to reduce exposure to active attacks. So that's some old tech, and that's a lot of really high CVSS scores.
That is. Now, for anyone who's never heard us go down this road before, Chris referenced the KEV, the known exploited vulnerability list, or which comes out of known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, which comes out of CISA. Folks, we've often discussed, Chris and I have, as this, the KEV, this catalog, this list being kind of like the final tripwire that should prompt you to patch. So first off, if we're here talking about the KEV, CISA's KEV, this is, you should patch this thing. And what that means is adversaries are known, not hypothetically, but are known to be exploiting this stuff out there in the wild. Now, to Chris's point, well, how old of a technology are we talking about here? In some cases, we are talking about some age, for sure. ColdFusion being targeted here. Exploited only days after Adobe rolled this out. A couple CVEs associated with LangFlow security, ColdFusion and LangFlow getting added in there. But the thing that kind of really brings this to light, folks, is that CISA is like, hey, this is not just for federal agencies. Obviously, even though they have the ability to issue a directive to the federal agencies, if I'm using my words correctly there, they also recommend everyone do this thing. Like, I feel like this is one of the best resources that's out there. If you're running a vulnerability management program for an enterprise organization, this needs to be on your radar of like, hey, we should be paying attention to these. I'd argue it's your last chance before you show up on a target victim list somewhere. I don't mean you're going to be in the news, but I mean an adversary is going to identify you with an open vulnerable instance and, you know, throw you in the target list for compromise there. So first off, to Chris's point, yes, older technology, but very, very high CVSs. Second, the fact that we're talking about it via this medium means patch, patch, patch. If you are, you know, running any of these types of things, Joomla extensions, ColdFusion, looking at the LangFlow and whatnot, like, folks, this is your last chance. And I say that not as like an omen or some sort of, you know, dark skies upon us kind of a thing, but I say this as like, if it's at the point where CISA is advising you this stuff has been exploited in the wild, please be warned. It is not because it happened yesterday, right? We're talking, it's known, it's been investigated, it's been attributed. Get the, you know, get your patching in place here. I can't stress that one enough. Chris, we've got, you know, lots of episodes where we've kind of joked around about patch, patch, patch and whatnot, but I just want to use this as a chance to say, hey, you and I are talking about this. There's 2 or 3 days left. There is a CISA mandate with a specific date of when this stuff needs to be patched. No questions asked. Like, folks, if you ever needed a, are we at risk? This is the best barometer you'll ever get.
Yeah, and I find it interesting too, because, you know, it talks about these things being exploited right after the CVEs are published. And I think we're going to just see that time to exploitation get smaller and smaller because they can literally do like spawn camping with AI on the CVE list. And as soon as the CVE is announced, they're like point the AI at the machine and say, hey, there's some kind of vulnerability here. Find it.
Yeah.
And the machine's going to be really good at doing that. And you don't even need, you know, Mythos or something like that. Like there's jailbroken open source models that you can run on a couple of video cards in your studio and get results. So,
Patch, patch, patch.
Yeah, I'll get off the soapbox. It's a fun soapbox, though. I think we both like that one. So
we do. We do.
All right, last up, researchers have disclosed a new attack technique called Halu squatting that exploits predictable hallucinations generated by AI coding assistants. The attack takes advantage of situations where an AI assistant invents the name of a software repository or plugin that does not actually exist. Attackers can identify these repeatedly hallucinated names, register them on platforms such as GitHub or plugin marketplaces, and embed prompt injection instructions with them. Wow. When a user later asks an AI coding assistant to retrieve the desired resource, the assistant may generate the same incorrect name, download the attacker's repository instead of the legitimate one, and execute the embedded instructions. According to the researchers, this creates a path to execute attacker-controlled code on the user's machine and could potentially be used to assemble large botnets. The attack combines two existing AI behaviors. The first is hallucination, where the model confidently generates incorrect information. And the second is indirect prompt injection, where malicious instructions are hidden within content retrieved by the AI rather than being directly entered by the user. The researchers found that attackers could repeatedly query AI assistants to identify the fake repository names that models consistently generated for trending projects that were too new to appear in their training data. Once the attacker registers those names, users requesting the popular project may instead receive the malicious repository. Because many AI coding assistants include integrated terminal functionality, the compromised assistant can execute commands contained within the malicious repository. In testing, researchers observed hallucinated repository names appearing consistently across different prompts and across multiple AI models, with success rates reaching as high as 85% for repository requests and 100% for skill installation. The researchers evaluated the technique against several AI development tools, including Cursor, Windsurf, GitHub, Copilot, C-Line, Google's Gemini CLI, and the OpenClaw family of assistants. In each case, they successfully demonstrated execution of harmless placeholder payloads through the compromised AI assistant. The research was conducted by Aya Spira and colleagues from Ben Nasai's research group at Tel Aviv University, sorry if I butchered your names, together with Stav Cohen from Technion and Ron Bitten from Intuit. Before publicly disclosing the findings, the team notified the affected vendors, AI model developers, and marketplace operators while deliberately withholding the detailed steps required to reproduce the attack. The article also places Halu squatting with a broader trend of AI-assisted attacks, referencing previous slop squatting, where attackers target hallucinated software package names, and phantom squatting, which involves hallucinated domain names. Halu squatting extends these concepts by enabling code execution through AI agents capable of fetching external resources and running commands. The article argues that primary defense is preventing AI agents from automatically retrieving and executing external resources without verification. Developers are encouraged to implement resource lookups before fetching repositories, allowing AI assistants to confirm that requested repositories actually exist rather than relying on generated names. The article also recommends training AI planning components to treat actions such as cloning, installing, or fetching external resources as higher risk operations that require additional validation. For users and security teams, the guidance is to avoid unattended execution modes that disable permission prompts, such as Claude Code Skip Permissions option. Guilty for using that all the time, or Gemini CLI's YOLO mode. Instead, users should verify repository and package names before allowing AI assistants to download or execute them. The researchers also suggest that software hosting platforms could reduce risk by reserving commonly hallucinated repository names or preventing reuse of well-known project names across new accounts. They conclude that Halu squatting is not the result of a single software vulnerability, but rather reflects a broader weakness in how AI agents trust and act on names they were never explicitly given. This is fascinating. Right away, I'm thinking we need like DNS for like everything. You know, with certs, like you start a project, you register the name, you give it a cert, and that's where the AI goes to get the thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I find this one to be pretty interesting. There's a lot of associated articles here that I've kind of opened up, and Chris, we probably could get all the links in the show notes and whatnot. Really, you know, people who are taking advantage of, I feel like, some of the nature of automated AI tools and whatnot. I understand that some of the advice given is don't run these things on auto mode. But the flip side of that is, okay, I'm going to get prompted for every single
300 times.
Every single library. And I think the assumption there is that everyone's going to be reading them and whatnot, right? Some tools add a safety layer that inspects what the agent reads or is about to do before it acts, like auto mode or Conseco, that lowers the risk rather than removing it. I think that's the important takeaway there is, like, you know, there's got to be, I say this because it's much easier said than done, but there's got to be like different or better security mechanisms in place to help protect against these kinds of things. And I just don't think we're there yet. The idea of AI agents being able to iterate fast and quick and move and build is based around this idea that it can look up and perform its own analyses and its own research and whatnot. And then to have someone who's like, oh, I can take advantage of the way that it does that, is going to find a little bit of success until it's fixed. I do think this is a fascinating change from AI usage and AI implementations. And where I'm going with this, everyone, is in the exact same episode, Chris and I are talking about vulnerabilities in Cold Fusion and Joomla and whatnot. And then we're also talking about how people are taking advantage of AI hallucinations and prompt injections and stuff. And it's like within this little span of window, we're talking about drastically different implications, drastically different vulnerabilities, all of which rely on the way that computers and the way that software was built and the way that it's meant to do a particular thing. It's a system abuse, if you will. And this is one area where you're right. Users should be, you know, auditing their commands and watching what they're doing and everything like that. But Chris, I'll be the first one to say it. Nothing production facing, but there's been situations where I've opened an AI tool in auto mode or whatever the, you know, terminology for that particular tool is. And then, hey, I'm going to be back in 30 minutes. When I'm done, I hope this thing is finished. And I just let it crank and I let it go. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of folks who are doing that for production cases as well. And that's going to be the slippery slope or the tricky thing to jump over is, you know, allowing these things in production mode, number one. Number two, who's going to go back and audit all of them, right? And then number three, let's just say your AI is going to be following a 10-step process and it gets injected or hallucinated in step, you know, three of those 10 steps. Does that mean the other six or seven steps are poisoned? Or does it mean there's a malicious vulnerability or a malicious library? I mean, it's just, it's a really crazy thing to think about, but lots of takeaways there. And I think a very big sign for the future of kind of AI and Gen AI security and things like that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's also why I have like five computers. Three stunt computers, one personal computer, and one work computer, right? So,
Yeah,
because YOLO mode, I don't know how else to like sitting there and approving things and reading it like that, just that doesn't work with the speed that we're quickly becoming accustomed to, right? So,
yeah, no, totally understood. But I mean, we'll see what it turns into. I think where I was getting at with my little monologue there was, we're seeing such a rapid development of AI and an explosion of AI implementations. And I feel like the vulnerabilities and the attack surface of AI agents is just, it's keeping pace, Chris, is where I'm going with that. And it's one thing of like, you have a super fast piece of moving software implementation and then a super fast, you know, exploit or vulnerability development cycle right behind it. Security needs to be operating at the same pace. I'm just going to call it what it is. Security's got to be operating at the same pace to keep par here.
Awesome. And I'm going to try and get this episode out fast. I got another one in the queue before it, but I think I can probably get it out tomorrow. So previously we'd worked with a video editor and for a bunch of reasons, we had to sort of end that relationship, and all good, just life. And so I, instead of hiring another person, started playing around with Claude Code, and I've got an automated pipeline that does a pretty good job of editing these things. So I think the time from recording to publication, we'll probably get it down to the same day next week. And then the things we're talking about won't be outdated by the time people hear it. So I'm pretty excited about that. Sucks to lose the editor, but you know, upwards and onwards, right?
Getting to flex those AI skills, though. Come on now.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, it does like all things the AI does, I feel like it's like 80-90% as good.
Yeah,
but fast and cheap. So that's a trade-off I'm willing to make in this case. So.
Yep, absolutely.
All right. Awesome, sir. We'll see you next week.
Always a pleasure, Chris. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.